Comedy wasn't ever something that I thought of doing professionally or as a vocation, but it's certainly something I was obsessed with and would drive many miles to see and stay up very, very late to see the shows I want. And
this is Michael Delaney.
Hi, I'm Michael Delaney.
And Michael Delaney has a lot of titles.
No, and that's a struggle for me. At UCB, we tried to come up with a title for me, and we came up with Sketch Czar, but that really doesn't... That doesn't say it, so we just left me sort of titleless.
Titleless? You are you.
Yeah, I'm just Delaney.
That works.
And when I die, no one will take my place.
Do you? Should I call you Michael Delaney, Mike?
Yeah, Michael Delaney, please.
Del.
I guess people call me Delaney.
So, I'm Andrew Steven. He's Delaney. Welcome to the CISO C Show.
Well, I got into it as a kid, as in loved it and sought it out. But I never got into it until I think I was about 20, maybe. Getting a VCR was a huge life-changing experience for me,
Yeah. Which
meant I could go total immersion, which is really what I wanted. And that was kind of pretty new in the 80s. And I was studying art at community college and got caught up in the theater. I volunteered to student direct a show, and somebody dropped out and they made me do a part, and I really didn't want to. And I was very uncomfortable and quite bad at it, too. But it was just so much more fun. And I was, at that time in my life, pretty much willing to abandon anything and everything on a whim to do whatever I felt like doing. So when all that theater stuff came up, it wasn't hard to forget about pretty much everything else that I was doing. All the people all around me were all actors, all people who wanted to be actors, and I had no intentions of becoming an actor. But I just fell in love with the professor there, Frank Leahy. And he was hugely influential, and all the stuff that I learned from Frank was very sympathetic and resonant with the stuff I would learn later that came from Del Close. And I think the first Kool-Aid that someone drinks is very significant. You can't go back. There's only one first Kool-Aid. You can drink other Kool-Aid, so to speak, later and become obsessed with other things or turn on to other systems and things. But Frank Leahy and that theater department was the sort of first Kool-Aid I drank, and it was actor's Kool-Aid. And Frank was a method guy, and Del was a method guy. Elaine May and Mike Nichols and that whole gang, they're all method people. And for me, method improvisation is where it's at. Short form and that just be as funny as you can, as hard as you can, it's for me is just short form and organized grab ass.
I love the idea of, you know, just having that person, whether it's a professor or a friend or something, that's, like you said, that hands you that first Kool-Aid. And seemingly that you enjoy the Kool-Aid as well, too. You know, I mean, I think there's people in our life that give us Kool-Aid that we want to spit out. And then there's ones that we embrace.
Well, it's bitter. It's always bitter, and it's always an acquired taste.
Yeah.
And I think as a young person, sometimes you love that. You love the I don't know, kind of putting your ass on the line and sweating a lot. And
the process of acquiring the taste.
Yeah, the suffering was kind of part of it, and people were like real hard asses about stuff in the theater, and I had no discipline in my life at all, and maybe that's part of what I was craving, not craving as much, but that's something that I needed.
How did you get along with the other performers or the people who wanted to be actors?
Great. They were pretty blunt with me and told me how bad I was and that you needed to get better, and I did. I paid attention. I paid very close attention. And tried to do these things and wrap my head around all these things that we're being told to do. And it's hard when your body and your ego aren't ready for those things. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time for me to get my body into it and just learn how to control my body enough just to even be heard on stage and to carry myself properly. And then to get for your ego to get over the things and to learn how to really create in the right way. I think when you first start, there's no wrong way to create. But then you start to get good, and you start thinking, oh, maybe I can make money doing this. And that's when it's time to fucking grow up and become a pro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said. So what brought you sort of in the next phase after, you know, theater in college?
I really wanted to do comedy and try improv. You know, I'd heard about improv and not, seen very little of it. But
what
seen
were the first
some,
things you had seen?
Really, Second City and, like, Whose Line Is It Anyway? And there was some small troupe in Florida called Mental Floss who was later lost in a hurricane. Their theater blew away in one of the big hurricanes when Florida got hammered some years back. And so it was just bits and pieces, and I would take these long journeys from South Florida to Second City, Chicago, and Second City, Toronto, just to see comedy. And I'll tell you what happened. Billy Merritt came along. That's really what happened. And Billy was just so funny. We were doing The Mystery of Edwin Drood at the time, and that had a lot of improv in it. And it had, like, all different endings and different combinations, and the audience would vote, and, like, lots of audience interact, that sort of improv, Broadway-style improv, and which is not long form, of course. And so we just, there was a lot of improv in the rehearsal process, and Billy was just so clearly the funniest person in not just the room, but probably the campus. And I felt like that was just sort of life green-lighting me, saying, now you can start a comedy group, because you need at least one other person. And once I found Billy, it was just away we go.
So did you approach him and, like, let's do this, or was there...
I think we were both in agreement, like, hey, yeah, let's do something.
Did you have to, like, work up the nerves to ask him or something like
no,
that?
No,
ready to do something?
No, we became friends, you know, and thought, what the hell, we'll put something together. So we just... We got our friends who were whatever, who were close enough and available enough, and put together our group. We did a lot of sketch and a lot of really grab-ass improv. We had no idea what we were doing, improvising. And but there was enough sketches in there that we had some solid material. But we wrote a new show each week, which was very challenging.
Very challenging.
We played at a little joint in town called the Arts Bar. And I knew we were improvising badly and not doing it very well. And in fact, someone came and told us that one time, one of Billy's mom's friend, his mom, Marcia Merritt, brought a friend whose name I forget. And she sat us down and you know, she was very complimentary, but she was very careful saying things like, you guys are very funny. You're very talented. She would not say she liked the show at all. Because she didn't, because she was a trained improviser, and she knew how badly we were operating. And she sat us down and told us about the Harold and about the National Improv Theater, and that you can learn the Harold there. And that's what I did. And I went and studied there, and I learned the Harold there, and learned the Del Close method there, because the woman, the guru of that theater, Tamara Wilcox-Smith, was a member of the committee. And she worked intensively with Del and really absorbed kind of his style. And she had her own take on his style, but it was definitely core Del Close stuff. So their curriculum was super Del-driven. And that was my first improv Kool-Aid. I'd already drunken theater Kool-Aid. And I, as a fan, I had my little Kool-Aids that I drank, SCTV in particular, and Monty Python, I was pretty obsessed about. But my SCTV obsession was at its height when I had no desire to be a performer whatsoever. I was going to be a visual artist. But I digress. Where was I?
You, the National Improv Theater.
Oh,
what,
yeah.
What year was that?
About 92, 91. I think I started training there in 91, 92. And then by then, Dave Blumenfeld had joined the comedy group down south. And when I would go down and visit periodically, I really, really enjoyed playing with him. And we became comedy partners later. And so I encouraged those guys to move up, and they did. And we formed a group at NIT called Lost Footage. And NIT did not like the idea of me just starting my own group whole hog for my friends. But we were good, and nobody else was really had the energy, I think, and the talent that we did. So we got our own show. We had Friday nights. And very small crowds. And just quiet, just crickets between set. We would do little forms and just have great gaps of silence between them. And that's when Bobby Kennedy volunteered to be our musician, because he just as an audience member, he couldn't handle the amount of those horrendous gaps of silence. And then Bobby became a big part of the group.
So those shows you were putting on, were they improv and sketch, all improv?
All improv. Billy Merritt calls the medium form because we're doing a little bit of long form, but also like short form, still doing short form bits and trying to come up with original forms was like the thing. Because we wanted to stretch, you know, wanted to stretch and do new things. So our solution was invent our own new forms. Like we learned, I don't know why we didn't just do the Harold. I guess... I don't know.
You want to be unique. You want to be original.
We did Harold-esque stuff, but we did other things too.
Do you remember any of the forms that you played
Christ.
Around with?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, but I don't care to elaborate.
Okay, this one everyone has to be on 1 foot at a time, but doing a long scene.
No, we were way stuffier than that. Way more pretentious than that.
Okay.
Yeah. We all wore black. We all wore uniform, and other groups would make fun of us. But they didn't have much of an opportunity because no one ever came to see us. Nobody.
But you had the Friday nights.
At NIT. Oh, but that theater quickly, A, hired my wife and I to teach for them, didn't pay us, promptly left town, closed up, shuttered up the theater and left. So we got now no theater, and we didn't get paid.
What was the... climate, I guess, of non-stand-up comedy in New York at that time?
Oh, it was chilly, vacant, and vapid,
yeah.
a bit vapid. There was a few teams. There was like little teams around, and I would go patronize all the other teams. I wanted to know what was going on, and then secretly feel superior to them. While not doing better shows or drawing bigger crowds than them, but yet feeling like, oh, yes, we're better, we're the best. But they weren't especially friendly. There was kind of a scene uptown. A guy named Tom Soder had a thing where, like, people would get together, but then UCB came in. I think he did his thing on Sunday nights, and then UCB came to town and started doing Ass Cat on Sunday nights, and that got really popular. And quickly... all the really talented people around, like Sean Conroy and so many, Eddie Pepitone, a lot of those, Chicago City Limits is what it was.
Yeah.
That was the sort of, I think they were trying to be a Second City clone, but they didn't have the sketch mite at all, CCL didn't. It was mainly short form driven.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very good at the short form. They would do these really, really crowd-pleasing shows. But UCB was doing the long form, and a lot of those guys, everybody tried it, but a lot of them defected, particularly some of our main people who became main UCBers, like Paul Scheer and Rob Hubel, and of course Sean and the Swarm guys, Andy Daly and Andrew Secunda.
So what was it about that ASCAD and when UCB came, like, that were they just that much different and better than everyone else? That it,
yes.
Or was it the timing thing, the right place at the right time? Or
definitely. Both of those. The timing was 100% there. And they were certainly better than everybody. I thought they were head and shoulders better than everyone. They were doing better than we were, and I think better than any other improv group I'd ever seen in town. And mainly because they played at the top of their intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told to do that, and we would do it, but not to the degree that the UCB took it, which is really what good actors do.
Yeah.
It's sort of be playing that sort of American method of stand there, look them in the eye, and tell the truth, and cut the bullshit. Mm-hmm. And we just hadn't cut the bullshit yet, where we're still trying to be funny all the time, and... yeah, we all want to be funny, but the UCB somehow had, I don't know, they were all fresh off working with Del Clo, being, I think, close with working with Del, and also being teachers themselves, which kind of keeps you in line a little bit as a performer when you teach, because you don't want to feel like a fucking hypocrite all the time.
Yeah. Well, and just to cut in there, because when I first started hearing terms like top of your intelligence, I always assumed it was meant play it like a smart person. But really, the example that they give, that UCB gives in their improv manual, is like, if someone pulls a gun on stage, you'd be scared that someone's pulling a gun.
Yeah.
And so often I think a characteristic of bad improv is like, oh, what, that's the squirt gun or whatever. Not to say that that can't be a scene that could turn into something, but to play it off the top of your intelligence for those listening who maybe not know, it'd be like, react as if you would, like you're a real person.
And as a beginning improviser, negotiating those two things of playing real and yet embracing the absurdity of the scene and the game of the scene. The trick is to be selective. Yeah. There's only room for one absurdity. And really, in a good scene, there's one chief absurdity. There's others that can surround it or perhaps follow it or accompany it, but it usually boils down to one main thing. And people are so eager to make so many things in a scene unusual that, and I've said this before, but one thing I noticed about the UCB when I first started watching them improvise is how much less they did than everybody else and how much more effective they are. And when I look at really good actors, I see them doing less. And it's about the choices they make and the conservation of energy in those choices.
Yeah, there's a story that Andy Samberg has about coming out and going to audition for Groundlings.
Uh-huh.
And like day one of the, you know, audition / class, the instructor gets up, lines them all up and says, do whatever you have to do to keep my attention. And so everyone just starts like yelling and flailing arms and doing weird, quirky, wacky, absurd stuff. And he was just overwhelmed. He's like, this is not the place for me, and never came back, you know. And I think, again, that's a good sort of example. And I don't mean to disparage other greats, because there's funny people.
He probably got their attention by never coming back.
And then look at him now. And so, not to say that there aren't funny people who, you know, I know some great, I have friends that do stuff at Groundlings that are hilarious, funny, amazing people. But it is that different approach of like the play it real, this, you know, do, like you said, do less, focus on the
Groundlings is for yang driven players as opposed to yin driven players. Places like IO and even Second City will tolerate the yin types, but you can only afford a few people who are very yin heavy in one group. And I think, I think Mad TV would be a sketch show, which is very yang heavy, very external, you know, and I think Groundlings are very external and very much about just go for the jugular, mm-hmm. you know, take care of yourself.
And when it works, it's huge.
Well, yeah, they're geniuses do well there.
Yeah, but when it fails huge as well, too.
I don't see it. That's the thing. I develop my own personal attitude about the Harold. That improvising for me in the Harold, I fall into it, but I try not to. I try to see it as not ever a pass-fail situation. And I think
shooting
that,
me down here. Just
well, I think this Keith Johnstonian pass-fail, you know, seeing it, improv as failing is something we got to let go of when we're really practicing the Harold. Because just because something's funny doesn't mean it's a failure. And I found out that I excelled best as an improviser when I kept myself just into the realm of things that are true. And that, to me, wasn't a hindrance. It didn't hamper me as an artist in any way. But when I would go out of the realm of things that were true into bullshit, that's when I would start feeling like this is pass-fail. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to be funny. And if I'm not, I feel weird and the audience feels weird and I'm red-cheeked and I go back to the back wall. But if I just shoot for the truth and try to play the truth of the scene, which a lot of times is a funny or absurd kind of core thing in the scene, but stick to the truth, everything else would take care of itself. And that's worked for me. That doesn't work for everybody, but it sure works for me.
I think that's a good remember, too. And because I definitely can relate and, you know, resound with what you're saying there. But it is so easy to sort of slip into the pass-fail worldview of looking at it. Not just comedy, but one's life in that sort of the way.
We all feel the burn if you're out there and you start that scene and time's going by and nothing's happening. But then there's certain players that I watch who do these long-ass scenes without getting laughs and just really, you know that they're digging being on stage and that they're comfortable with the world they created on stage and safe in the knowledge that the laughs will come and not let them compromise the choices that they're making because they're not coming soon enough. And I think too many of us, and I'm included, will cave in and make moves just to get a laugh instead of conserving that energy and working towards the game that's really worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so good. So good. And it's cliche and it's been said 100 times before, but it really is a great life philosophy as well, too.
Those things resonate all the time. Like in my life, I got rid of the bullshit and I got rid of the lies because I used to lie to people all the time, either to protect myself, to make myself look better because I wanted to look smarter or cooler, or to get a skirt around a law or a rule. And I think fibbing to not get arrested is one thing. But doing it, once I started eliminating the lies from my life, that was around the same time that I was eliminating the bullshit from my performing and trying to simplify and do less on stage and, in a way, do less in life. And when you do less, you end up doing more. Less is more. I'm not the first one to say that.
What?
But Frank Leahy's the first one who told me less is more, and it hit me like a bullet.
Yeah.
And I loved that. I'd never heard less is more before, and he lectured on it, and it was like I'd been waiting all my life to hear that.
Today's episode of the CSOC Show is brought to you by Casper. Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Supportive memory foams create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. And Casper offers free shipping and returns to US and Canada. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. You can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/CISO and using offer code CISO. That's S-E-E-S-O. And if you don't prefer the risk-free trial, there's always the high-risk trial. It involves a luge, 4 weeks in the outback, basic survival skills, and day trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Once again, get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/CISO and using offer code CISO. That's S-E-E-S-O. Terms and conditions apply. So what was it like, I guess, you know, now UCB's in town. How soon was it before it became, you know, like it's now an institution, but like, because originally they were doing shows and then just started teaching to sort of make some extra money.
I think so. I went and saw their sketch shows and I really liked the sketch shows, but I wasn't blown away. I didn't feel like their sketch shows necessarily showed me things I hadn't seen before, but I thought they were all really good. But there was this thing, this trend was starting of really connected sketch shows, like Mr. Show style, mm-hmm. that reflecting the Harold within a sketch show with having, you know, disparate stories, and callbacks and connections. And so the UCB was very innovative in that way. And I thought all their sketch shows were super high quality, super innovative, but it was the improv that blew me away and was paradigm changing for me. I thought that their connectivity and their sketch writing and performing was solidifying for the style that was coming around. Like, you know, Pinata Full of Bees kind of changed, you know, and Mr. Show were changing the way we looked at our sketch shows, and they were representing that. But for me, as a budding improviser, or as a practicing improviser, it was their long form that knocked me out. So we just asked those guys to come coach us. And after a couple one-offs, I think we settled in on, I was so excited that we had new blood in town, because I love the Harold and really wanted to explore the Harold more, but there just wasn't any players or directors around, and I don't think anybody was particularly interested in our group or in me.
Yeah.
And And UCB were the only ones who would give us the time of day. But, of course, we were hiring them to coach us. But, no, they were cool. We took their classes. And I forced my whole group, Lost Footage, to take a class with them. And some of us stuck around. Some didn't. The ones that stuck around ended up making the Swarm. We had a little – I had a little side group on the interim, though. We first got Ian to direct Lost Footage, but – we started a side group called Naked Apartment, and we had Amy Poehler directing us in that one. So I had, like, Ian on – it was probably Ian on Fridays and Amy on Sundays or something like that. So I, plus taking classes. So I was getting a good, rounded improv education. So, yeah, studied with those guys for a while. I think I only paid for one class. I paid for my first class, but then after that – I volunteered to be their light guy because I used to do lights for plays.
So you started the intern program as well, too.
I was really kind of, I think Betsy Stover was the first official intern, but I was kind of the sort of a nominal, was an honorary intern.
Yeah.
And that was fun, too, doing the lights. And they would do sets after their shows and often call me up to join in on the sets, which was terrifying. And because I was not good and I had not adjusted to their. To that, that style of long form, of game-oriented long form, I hadn't quite fully adjusted to, but also their personal style was something that took me a while to adjust to, too. One of the big tenets we got back at the NIT and what I considered Cordell Close was this attitude that every great scene was usually about one thing. And that was Cordell that I had learned. But that was as hard as they hit it at the NIT. And it wasn't a primary thing. More agreement and forward movement were really the and playing different points of view and leaving yourself open to points of view. And Harold techniques was more the emphasis at NIT. And then with the NIT, there was with UCB, they were so game oriented that like I say, that resonated with this whole every great scene's about one thing. But it took it to another place, which allowed us. The Lost Footage guys and later the Swarm to play in a way that I had dreamed was possible but didn't think I would achieve and did. Well, UCB became a juggernaut at some point. There was a couple corners. We turned some corners. It was hard for a while. It was fun. And I remember when it was all starting, I think I had a feeling that it was going to be that this theater might stick around for a while. And on the first Del Close marathon, I think I had a feeling, hey, there'll be a bunch of these. I think this is the beginning of something. But I was very aware of it and spent zero time thinking about it. Because that's just wasted effort. All you can do is...
the best way to approach it.
Yeah, it's the English show. You just get on with it. And that's all we did was just do the work. And I started teaching and didn't know I was going to be any good at it. And I ended up being like the head teacher and having followers and things. And that was weird and kind of an... It was also kind of an ego fuck, like mind fuck in a way, too. And it was fun. It just turned into a job and an unexpected career. For me, just as I think having a theater turned into a very unexpected thing for the UCB. Sort of caught them unawares. And, yeah. Yeah, these things just came up, and the marathon just came up, and now it's an institution.
That's our show this week. Thanks so much for listening. And a huge, huge special thanks to Michael Delaney for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. I mean that sincerely, so thank you.
All right.
I hope you all have a wonderful week. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Andrew Steven. The show is at CISO Show. And that's all I've got for now. Take care. See you next week.